Now, from the left coast, another in-depth interview from Peter B. Collins. Peter B.'s been talking about news and politics since Watergate and generously shares his knowledge, wisdom, opinions, and outrage here because his friends and family can't take it anymore. Peter B.'s an independent progressive who upsets Democrats and Republicans as conditions require and is one of the few lefty pundits who predicted Trump would win. This podcast is funded entirely by listeners like you, and subscribers get first access to these in-depth interviews. When you're ready, go to peterbcollins.com/signup. Now, here's your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
Thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast at peterbcollins.com. Today, you're going to meet painter Rob Shetterly. He's an artist who's produced more than 200 portraits of Americans who tell the truth. And it's an impressive gallery of people I've admired and many of whom I've interviewed over the years. In this conversation, you'll find out what triggered this creative reaction in Rob Shetterly and his views about Trump and the truth. That's all ahead on this podcast, made possible by honest listeners like you who support my work with your subscriptions. Great people like John Morgan, Steve Wozinski, Judy Holloway, and Auntie Lundberg, they all kick in $5 or $10 a month, and I invite you to do the same. Just visit peterbcollins.com, click on menu, click on become a subscriber, you'll land on the sign-up page, and I think you can take it from there. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting your favorite podcast. America is suffering from an enduring, long-term truth emergency. Many public figures no longer feel bound to tell the truth.
Smiling faces sometimes pretend to be your friend. Smiling faces show no traces of the evil that lurks within. Smiling faces, sometimes they don't tell the truth.
That's an understatement.
Smiling faces, tell lies.
And I got proof. That's some electric Motown to get the podcast started today. The artist is called The Undisputed Truth. Smiling Faces Sometimes is the tune. And last summer, I had a great opportunity meeting Rob Shetterly in Bristol, Maine. I was on vacation, and a longtime listener and supporter, Abby McMillan, said, hey, I'd like to organize a little dinner. And I ended up getting to meet Rob Shetterly and Abby and Mike McMillan and Rob's partner, Gail, as well. We had a fine time. And recently, Colonel Ann Wright, the retired Army colonel who is a member of Code Pink for Peace and an outspoken activist for peace in this country, posted a video. And I think it was from Syracuse where an exhibit of Rob Shetterly's portraits of Americans who tell the truth, who told the truth, yes, was on display. And Rob Shetterly joins me today on the Peter B. Collins podcast. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. And I really want people to experience your work. And I'm going to put a link in the show file for today's podcast to your website, AmericansWhoTellTheTruth.org. And you're a talented painter. You've focused on portraits. And explain to our listeners why you decided to focus your work on Americans who tell the truth. You've now done well over 200 portraits of people who fit that characterization.
Well, let me just say that I didn't want to. I am a self-taught artist. I've been living in Maine for almost 50 years. I came here as part of the Back to the Land movement, and when I was a much younger man, by kerosene light at night, I taught myself how to draw and paint. And I gradually developed a style that, for lack of better words, would be called a surrealist, I guess. I was always interested in ambiguity, mystery, and thought that I was doing the best thing I could as an artist by exploring those mysteries of human behavior through my images. But what happened to cause me to switch dramatically was the run-up to the Iraq War, which some of your listeners will remember actually within hours of 9/11, Rumsfeld and some others were suggesting that one of the answers to 9/11 was to attack the country of Iraq, which, of course, had nothing to do with 9/11, and also did not have weapons of mass destruction or any links to al-Qaeda or any other stuff they were saying.
Right.
And was no threat to the United States. And, you know, I've lived here long enough to smell a rat, and I thought, you know, this was terrible. And I guess I was not as concerned about the government lying. I mean, that happens a lot in any country. But I was most disturbed by the corporate media cheerleading for this war instead of investigating what was being said. And I began to get filled with an enormous rage, what Terry Tempest Williams calls sacred rage, and an equally weighty grief about all the victims that were going to be. And I thought, you know, either I've got to do something at this moment to feel, one, less alienated from this country, and two, have some kind of voice, even if it's just for myself, you know, in a very small way. I've got to do it. Otherwise, I should probably not live in this country any longer. And I also thought that it should involve the thing I do best, which is paint. I had never painted a portrait in my life, and it was really bothering me about what it is I should do. And I did know that it had to involve something positive rather than something negative. You know, I mean, I had been all during that first year of the, or first few months of the run, you know, when the rhetoric started to attack Iraq, I was spending a lot of time ranting, and I was making myself sick. I really believe that. I was getting sick from the anger and the anxiety. And so I finally, this very simple thing happened. I thought, well, why don't I start surrounding myself with people I admire from this country rather than, you know, rant about the ones I don't.
Mm-hmm.
And I painted Walt Whitman, and then I painted Frederick Douglass, and then I painted Sojourner Truth, and then I painted Susan B. Anthony and Jane Addams and Mother Jones. And, you know, I started with all these 19th century figures. And at the same time I was painting them, I was reading their biographies. I was, you know, really immersing myself in that history and discovering that, one, I didn't know these people deeply at all. I knew them only as names and icons. And also, I didn't really know their history well. And it was absolutely fascinating, both the painting and trying to evoke their spirits by painting their portraits and then learning the history. It never occurred to me at that moment that these paintings would travel around the country, that they would go to museums, libraries, colleges, schools, etc., churches. It was more of an art therapy project for myself, and a way of learning deeply.
And Rob, when did you switch to painting portraits of the living?
Well, I got about in the first few, there were portraits of people. I painted Howard Zinn early on, and I painted Wendell Berry early on, but it didn't occur to me that I would ever meet any of the people I was painting. I was just finding pictures wherever I could, on the backs of books or on the internet or in libraries. I was spending an awful lot of time in libraries. And it wasn't until I'd gotten, but I was focusing mostly on 19th century and early 20th century figures, and then I had this goal of painting 50 portraits, which I never thought I would actually do. I thought I would burn out much more quickly than that. And, you know, for a variety of reasons, have to go back to my other life. But it turned out that after I very quickly got to 50 portraits and realized I was just beginning. I mean, I was learning so much. I was finding, you know, I wanted to so much say so much more with the project. And so I started contacting living people and one way or another showing them what I'd been doing up to that point and saying, you know, could I add them to the collection? And so now there are over 150 living people in the collection, and it keeps going on and on.
Mm-hmm. And I mentioned Anne Wright. She has been a hero of mine since she resigned from the State Department in protest of the invasion of Afghanistan. And I have talked with her many times. She participates in the Gaza Freedom Flotillas. She protests the drone program at Creech in Las Vegas and anywhere else where they find them. And she is just so... I mean, she gives idealism a good reputation.
She sure does. I mean, she is everywhere and willing to go anywhere. I don't know. I mean, it turns out that Anne Wright and I were born both in 1946. And I travel a lot, but I don't travel anything like Anne Wright does. And I don't know how she does it. I mean, it's beginning to wear on me. You know, we're both 72 years old now, and I can travel around this country, but she travels internationally all the time, and I find that exhausting. But
she claims to have a home in Honolulu.
I talked to her about that. I was with her just two weeks ago, and she I mentioned that, and she says, "Oh yeah, I live in Hawaii." I said, "Oh, you do?" She says, "Yeah, I'm there about a month out of a year."
Yeah.
Not very often, but she is exactly what you say. I mean, not only does she do all the things that you just listed, but she does it with such great spirit. She is fiercely unintimidatable, but also fiercely joyous about the work she does and the communities that she involves herself with. I mean, she, you know, there was a point at which I, when I started this, my project, where I kept wondering, you know, how long I would go on. And then I got to know Anne Wright and her, you know, movement out of the government, out of the military, you know, it becoming a full-time activist in response to the Afghanistan and Iraq. I mean, that each one of the people, let me put it this way, each one of the people I paint becomes a model for something I would like to do, too, in a way. I'm obviously not going to do what everybody else does, but I like to model it and then use what the people I paint as models for other people. And Anne Wright was one of those people right from the beginning that helped me determine to not give up, to just keep going and going and going.
And, Rob, as I scroll through the gallery of paintings on your website, it triggers memories for me. I met Studs Terkel when I was a young Cub radio host in Chicago.
Really?
And he escorted a woman to my studio one night because she was unsure of what my intentions were. And he was the, you know, the elder figure who came over to this rock station to check out this long-haired kid whether this was legit. And we struck up a connection. I can't claim him as a friend, but I got to talk with him on three or four occasions. And his work as a radio host, as a conversationalist, made a big impact on me. And so it's very cool to see one of America's great storytellers in your collection of paintings. And he's right next to Helen Thomas, the fiery Lebanese-American White House reporter who I had a number of encounters with, and she always insisted on the truth, Rob. she didn't have a plan B or an alternate fact in her mind.
No, she was doing the people's work. I mean, she insisted that, you know, whoever she was talking to, and often the president, is answerable to the people and needs to be asked the toughest questions because the people have to know the answers. Otherwise, you know, the whole democratic experiment becomes meaningless. And she embodied that. I mean, I've had her right here in my living room one time a few years before she died, and she was that same way, you know, funny, feisty, incredibly outspoken, just a great, great person. I met Studs Terkel here in Maine. He was also a couple of years before he died. He has a family here, and he came to visit. And he was almost totally deaf then, not quite, but, you know, almost. And so he had to have somebody with him all the time whose lip patterns he could read easily, and so that person would, you know, listen to him, or would listen to the questions and repeat them to him, and then he would answer. But I'm sure you know from being around studs that here he was in his 90s, and the man could, you know, it was like some incredible memory machine.
You didn't
touch anything, anything he ever, any person he ever met, any experience he ever had, and he could tell you almost verbatim. What was said, what was thought, you know, and the history around it.
Mm-hmm.
Just an extraordinary person.
Yeah, he was. And I'm stuck in the S section here. David Swanson is a man who is a tireless advocate for peace. He's written numerous books. He organized a freedom camp that I attended on the Washington Mall. That would have been around 2004 or 2005. And he just continues to be a major force for truth and for freedom. And just one or two rows up, we've got Cindy Sheehan and her work challenging George W. Bush over the loss of her son Casey brought a real personal and emotional thread to the anti-war movement during the George W. Bush administration.
Yeah, let me I'd like to say something about Cindy. I haven't seen her in a while, but was actually, I left Maine to with a friend of mine to go down to Camp Casey, and you know, outside of Bush's ranch in Crawford, mm-hmm. Texas, to support Cindy. And who should I find there but Anne Wright?
Yep,
because she was everywhere. And I think that was actually the first time I knew about Anne Wright, but the first time I actually met her. But Cindy Sheehan, you know, at that moment, you know, leaving the Veterans for Peace Convention in Dallas and taking all those people to Crawford and insisting that Bush come out from his ranch and explain why her son Casey had died, for what noble cause he had died, was an extraordinary moment that I very few people remember anymore now, but it revitalized the anti-war movement after people were so depressed after all the demonstrations and the work to try to stop the Iraq War. It, you know, it didn't stop it at all. And she kind of, you know, picked people up again and got them active again. It was a great moment.
Well, Cindy later ran against Nancy Pelosi for Congress here in San Francisco. And at one point, she had purchased some land in Crawford and was trying to unload it. And I remember doing a podcast with her and kicking in $100 to, to try to help her either absorb the cost or sell it off. And I never heard what happened there. But she's a very interesting and outspoken woman. I have a lot of respect for her.
Yeah, I do too. And I but I want to. You mentioned David Swanson, and I just want to say another word about him.
Sure.
I mean, you mentioned him as being tireless. I mean, I don't know if there's anybody anywhere who thinks as hard and writes as fast and as hard as he does around issues around militarism, and constantly exploding the excuses and myths there are around, you know, why militarism persists and for whose benefit. He's become, I don't know, an essential person in this country for understanding what's really going on in terms of the military-industrial complex, you know, where the money is, and what we can do to try to put a break on that. Because it seems to me that if we don't, you know, with all the concern there is, and quite rightly, about climate, that unless we do something about the militarism piece of it, we may not be able to do enough about the climate, because of the contributions of our military to, its dependence on oil and the amount of you know, CO2 that it emits all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Bill McKibben is an obvious connection to what you just said. And he's right next to Ray McGovern. And I've known Ray now for 14 years.
Really?
I first connected with him after he appeared in a Robert Greenwald documentary about the path to the war in Iraq. And here's this former CIA guy who had done the daily briefing for Reagan and Poppy Bush, and he's standing up. And he is still standing up. My most recent interview with Ray was right before Thanksgiving. And he is still fighting the Russiagate false narrative. And he and I are part of a minority on the left who don't support Trump, but also don't believe the deep state claims of the Trump-Russia collusion. And as the work of Robert Mueller is revealed more and more, I'm seeing corruption, not collusion, and Ray McGovern's arguments, I think, are continuing to hold water. He's a feisty guy with a great sense of humor, and kind of like Cindy Sheehan and some of the others we mentioned, he brings a real spiritual approach to the work that he does, yet he's not preachy or dogmatic. And I just find him to be a superlative human being. Rob?
I'm glad you do. I do, too. I met him here in Maine when he was here to speak at a Veterans for Peace meeting or a convention or something. And excuse me, I have had a cold, and when I talk, it comes back a little bit. But, his organization, Veteran Intelligence Professionals, For sanity,
yes.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
is remarkable of these retired intelligence people who are sort of like an intelligence agency in waiting or in exile, who are trying to bring the truth to what's going on and try to do, you know, what the intelligence agencies were at least theoretically set up to do in the first place was not be political but tell the truth so that politicians could act knowing the truth. Instead of use them for their own political ends. And, he's been just appalled at the way intelligence agencies have been so easily corrupted to be political and serve the political needs of whoever's in office.
And by extension, the media has really done a disservice. I call it media malpractice. I call it yellow journalism. But we've seen a real reduction in standards as the corporate media feels its mission is to get Trump. And I'd love to see him get Trump. I want to see Trump gotten.
Right, exactly.
But not through leaks and anonymous sources and lies that I attribute to people like James Clapper and John Brennan. And these are some of the same foils that Ray McGovern tilts at on a regular basis. So I feel I'm in very good company there. But let's zoom out from these individuals for a moment, Rob,
sure.
And get your impressions of just how serious the problem is. We have a president who lies compulsively and multiple times a day. Prior to the midterms, as he was out staging his mob rallies across the country and claiming that it was Democratic mobs that everybody had to be afraid of, his lies were clocking in at 70% to 80% of what he uttered. And so we really have made a substantial departure from any standard of honesty and truthfulness in public dialogue. And we have to credit Stephen Colbert with coining the term truthiness. But Trump doesn't even attempt truthiness much of the time. He just makes shit up. And he slimes people with it. He has no problem attacking people with false information, and he never apologizes. So we've entered into an era that I fear there is possibly no return from.
Well, it's a I have a couple of different reactions to this. I mean, one is that, as you're suggesting, just the appalling nature of it, because a person with power, gives permission, literally, gives permission to people to think one way or another. If that power is used correctly and the person has respect for his own or her own ability as a teacher, the person then uses that permission giving to encourage people to be their better selves. And what we have now, of course, is a person who's in power who's using that position to give people permission to be their worst selves. And it is infectious, and it's doing a terrible thing to this country. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, you know, is that people in positions of power who lie about what this country's, I mean, he lies about everything. And so it becomes just this miasma of prevarication. But we've had other presidents, and all of the recent ones, who have lied, you know, extensively. And, of course, I started this project about because George W. Bush was lying us into a war. I mean, so far, I mean, you know, Trump has done incalculable damage to the fabric of the country. George W. Bush started wars that are still going on and have killed, I don't know, how many people? We don't have no idea. Millions, a million anyway, and injured millions more, dislocated, you know, millions beyond that. You know, everything that's going on in the Middle East, you can trace back to 2002 and 3.
And the tensions in Europe from migration of displaced people from America's
Syria,
wars.
ISIS, the whole business. I mean, so, you know, so I on the one hand, I agree, you know, I understand completely what you're saying. On the other hand, this sort of mask of civility, the suit, you know, that covers George Bush or even Obama at times, who was, you know, seemed to be a man of great integrity, was also lying to us about a number of things about the country and our history and about militarism and things. It's kind of baffling.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where the role of the media also becomes so important. I mean, they do feast on Trump to some degree, but, you know, they were so complicit in the lies of Bush and Obama that they don't go there.
Well, you make an excellent point, Rob, and I have called out the lies by omission and by commission of both Barack Obama and George W. Bush. But it's fair to say in Obama's case that he was much better with the optics, and he didn't poke you in the eye and say, "I'm lying." He was just so much more clever, and you know, he had dignity as he bullshitted us.
He certainly did. I mean, I think an awful lot of what people hoped for from him was the hope of a teacher, because he clearly knew something about history. He knew about the power that he was assuming. And he knew the effect he could have, and it's hard to know for sure what was really going on there, whether he wanted to do and be something other than the way he, what he ended up doing, or he was under enormous pressure from who knows exactly where it comes from, to do a bunch of things that caused him to be, you know, on the in some ways on the wrong side of where we needed him to be. But, you know, this, what I try to do, you know, with these portraits is an awful lot of it is about education now. I mean, for some reason, because of this, I've gotten access to schools all over the country, and which is quite interesting because I'll meet with people I paint and, you know, who are often fairly radical people. I mean, I don't like saying left and right. To me, this is all about truth and justice and the things, the ideals that we talk about. But I, you know, they don't often get invited into schools. But I can get into schools with their portraits and talk about, because it's an art project, and talk about what these people believe in, what they did, why it was necessary.
And as you're saying that, I'm looking at your portrait of Cynthia McKinney, the outspoken former congresswoman who probably can't get invited to Syracuse University these days.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, she's in exile right now. She's in Bangladesh teaching. I met a person at Syracuse a couple weeks ago who was a Bangladeshi woman who knows her well in Bangladesh now. I mean, Cynthia McKinney got so fed up with this country that she left. Yeah, I mean, no, she was saying things and standing up for things that a few other people could tolerate, and you know, know, she was persona non grata in this country.
Yeah. One of the other impressions that looking at your portraits produces in me is I was really moved by the exhibit that Ai Weiwei staged at Alcatraz. It's now almost 4 years ago. And in one room, he had these drawings that he had made of almost 200 political prisoners who at that point were incarcerated somewhere around the world. And he had them transferred to a tapestry made of Legos that were laid out on the floor of this huge abandoned warehouse building on the island of Alcatraz, the site of the former federal prison. And so to use a prison setting to draw attention to prisoners of war, and John Kiriakou, who you've painted, Ed Snowden, who you've painted, and a couple of others, including Shaker Amer, the British man who was held at Guantanamo until Andy Worthington's campaign forced his release. These, you know, the depictions of those individuals in that setting had a tremendous impact. And Ai Weiwei is a man who I have great admiration for. I got to meet and interview him a year ago when he was promoting his film about, it's called Human Flow, about migration. And he visited more than 25 refugee camps around the world. Now, his focus is a little different, but I see some similarities between the work that you took on and the mission that Ai Weiwei sees himself on.
Well, I'm certainly flattered by the comparison, but I think that the effort is done for a similar reason, is to put a face to, sometimes as he did, the victims, and then of course we sometimes paint the same people, so we're both painting people who are victims of injustice, but also people of enormous courage who've fought against it and tried to protect other victims. And I think that putting that face on it, you know, makes such an enormous difference. I mean, so much terrible mischief is done in the world by, you know, dehumanization, making people faceless, using, you know, branding them as a certain kind of bad person or somebody one needs to fear, and then unleashing anything against them. And, you know, to the extent that I can do what I do, it's to put faces on the people who are standing up for what I think of as, and I assume you do too, as the, you know, the ideals of the country. I mean, real equality, you know, real dignity, real rights, you know, real concern for the welfare of every person.
Well, Rob Shetterly, I'm really glad that Abby McMillan introduced us last summer. I'm very pleased to know you and your work. And now, in turn, I'm happy to share it with my listeners all across the country and around the world. And as we wrap up, I again want to reference your website, AmericansWhoTellTheTruth.org, and ask you to explain to listeners how they could invite you to bring a traveling exhibit to Montana or Florida or, yeah, I've even got listeners in Alabama.
Well, they just need to go to the website, and there is information there on contact information on for me and for getting in touch with the site. We've had some website problems recently, and we're putting...
It's the Russians. It's the Russians, Rob. I'm convinced. We know.
We do know that. but anyway, it's not hard to get in touch with me. And people, I travel around and speak. I go to schools. The portraits can be rented, and they travel literally all over the country. And they are, you know, they're pretty big. They're on wooden panels with these quotes from each person scratched into the surface, and they make quite an impact on wherever they go. Right now, the entire collection, for the first time ever, is being shown at Syracuse University and is there for another 10 days or so. And that's nobody, including myself, had ever seen them all together.
Oh.
Quite an event.
Mm-hmm.
I was extremely pleased. We had not just myself, but a number of people I painted were all there for the opening to speak about what this collection is all about.
Oh, that's very exciting. Well, Rob, thank you for joining me today. Again, I'll connect people via your website, and I hope you will keep painting portraits of Americans who tell the truth.
I will, and actually, can I have 1 second to say something?
Go ahead.
Well, my next portrait is a woman named Chanifa Kamvongsa. She is a Laotian American who's been working on exposing America's secret war in Laos during the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Laos was bombed more than any other country in the world per capita, and we weren't at war with them. This, I think, is a very important portrait coming up, and I'm very excited about telling her story.
Okay. Well, thanks for adding that, Rob. And thank you for joining us here today on the Peter B. Collins Podcast.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks for listening to this conversation with artist Rob Shetterly. Send your comments to peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.